שלום, ברוכים הבאים. I'm Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, and you are joining us on this live streaming of Awakening Torah, Musar, Mindfulness, where we look at the weekly Torah portion of the Hebrew Bible, also known as Torah, and we try to discover what our ancestors and God want us to get the most from the text each year for our own practice and path of Musar mindfulness, so that we're on this path towards holiness, taking refuge in community together here at the Institute for Holiness, live throughout the whole world, really taking refuge in the teachings of Musar in the Jewish tradition and mindfulness out of the Dharma of Vipassana, Theravada Buddhism. I'm delighted that you have joined us today. We are covering the Torah portion, not from 2 days ago, in which we will cover soon in a day or two, Bezrat Hashem, but the week before, which is Miketz. I've said this before, due to the ongoing war and the grief and loss and everything that's happened, it's deeply affected our community and me here at the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. And so we thank you for your patience and understanding that this material is coming out later than we wished it would be, but this is how it has to be. For instance, today there was hours of lack of electricity, most likely due to conditions of the war. So what do we do here? As you know, we begin with our kavanot, our intentions for today's session, where we will look at a certain section of Miketz from the Torah portion that's inside the book of Genesis, Bereshit. And then we will engage in mindfulness meditation together to practice and really take refuge, which requires radical self-care for to be able to care for others and bring God's good to others. So if you're joining us live now or will watch later on video or even audio and podcasts, welcome. You can reach us at our YouTube channel. Please subscribe under Musar Mindfulness and the Institute for Holiness. And you're welcome to come to our website at kehilatmusar.com. In order to join the mailing list there, please subscribe, consider becoming a member, reach out to me to see how you want to practice and be on this path. And of course, you can find us, God willing, live streaming on Facebook and either at LinkedIn or Twitter, wherever you follow us. So I'm going to share screen right now. Hopefully you will see this. This is our Kavanot. For those of you who have vision or are watching by video, otherwise I'm going to read these Kavanot, these intentions for today. So we see this time together, which is about 45 minutes to an hour of caring for the self. And we're doing this to strengthen our own soul in order to be of benefit to others in the future. And we also see this as doing an act for others, that we want to strengthen our relationship to others. We could be a better conduit of God's good that is so needed today when other people need us. And finally, we're doing this to strengthen our relationship to God, to the divine, to Hashem, however you might define higher power. This is something we want to strengthen our relationship to the Creator, and that enables us to be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. So I'm going to stop sharing screen for those of you by video. Otherwise, you will have heard this on the podcast on audio. So what we do first is share a brief summary. Now, this is, I believe, is our 10th sitting. 1, 2, 3, 9, 10. Yes, sir. Yes. Miketz is the 10th parsha in the book of Genesis, in the first of five books of Moshe and the Torah. And this came about on Dalet, the Hebrew date of Dalet of Tevet, the month of Tevet, of Tovshin Pei Dalet, 5784 is the year. And that corresponds with the secular calendar of December 16th, 2023. So I'm just going to give a brief summary of what happened. Hopefully you've had time to study this and have heard it read maybe in synagogues at a minyan laned for the Torah portion. Okay. So in this Torah portion, Paro, Pharaoh of Egypt, has two dreams that he cannot understand. And so his cupbearer, if you recall, the cupbearer who was in prison with Yosef, who is our main ancestor through these four parshiot, the cupbearer remembers Yosef and recommends him to Paro to interpret dreams. Because in prison, in the bor, in the pit, Yosef interprets those dreams of the cupbearer, and they come true. So the cupbearer sees him as valid. So Paro sends for Yosef, who says that God is sending a message that there will be 7 years of plenty of food, followed by 7 years of famine in the land. And it's not going to be just in Egypt and Mitzrayim. It's going to affect all the lands in the area, including the land of Canaan. Canaan is a part of the area of modern Israel. The modern state of Israel is in that area. Okay. So Yosef advises Paro to store food during the years of plenty. Paro is so impressed by his wisdom, which is God's wisdom, and appoints Yosef as his second in command. So 7 years later, so this had the 7 years of plenty happen. Then 7 years later, after this, a famine begins. And Yaakov sends his sons. Yaakov is the father of Yosef, just to remind you. Yaakov sends his sons down to Egypt south to buy food. But he will not send down Binyamin. He only sends down the 10 brothers, who you may recall are the very ones that, well, nine of them, as far as we know. Reuven, we're not sure. We don't think that he was involved in the sale, but the other nine were involved in the sale of Yosef into slavery. They are the ones that threw him into a boar, and then it seems to be that they sold him. So this now means that it's actually the second year in the famine when they arrive. All right, so they seem to have survived 2 years in the famine before they are desperate, starting to, I wouldn't go as far as say starve, but it's on the brink, and so they head down. So when the brothers come before Yosef to buy food, because he is the visor, he is the one that determines who will get what food, how much, and when, and he recognizes, okay, I want you to pay attention to the verb that I will use here, recognize, lehakir, right? And he recognizes them, they do not recognize him, okay? We're going to talk a lot about this and what this means. Yosef accuses them of being spies. Now, they don't know that this is Yosef. They think this is just some Egyptian visor. So he accuses them of being spies. He imprisons one of the brothers, Shimon, and he insists that the others return to get the youngest brother, Benjamin. Okay? Now, Yaakov first refuses to let Benjamin go, right? He doesn't want to lose another son, particularly his favorite son. Benjamin has now become the favorite son of Yaakov, the other son born by his favorite wife, who, may her memory be for a blessing, is not with Yaakov anymore. She passed away, Rachel. She actually passed away by birth while birthing Binyamin. And so he doesn't want to lose him the way he thinks that he's lost Yosef. Okay. So Yaakov finally allows Binyamin to go down because they're so desperate for food. So the brothers go back to Egypt, to Mitzrayim with Binyamin. Now, when Joseph, who is the visor again, who they have to appear before when they come into the land, when he sees Benjamin, he actually has to run out of the room to cry. Now, I believe if you, I can't remember the exact number, I think it's four times. Four times Joseph will have to, I don't want to say excuse himself, but he leaves the room to cry. Okay. He's very emotionally, there's a lot of reactivity and a lot of the emotion involved in what's going on here. Okay. So he leaves the room to cry. He has a meal. He returns. He's able to have some composure. He returns and has a meal with these brothers who still don't know it's him, right? He still doesn't tell them who he is. And then Yosef gives the brothers the food they came to purchase in order to return back home to the land of Canaan. And he secretly has his silver goblet, gavia, placed into Benjamin's sack. And when the goblet is discovered, which of course Joseph sets this up to send over a guard to check their sacks and to accuse them for stealing, Joseph accuses Benjamin of stealing from him and says that Benjamin is going to have to stay behind in Egypt as a slave because of the act of stealing. Okay, that is a general summary of what we have before us in this Torah portion. Now, a lot happens here, right? A lot of difficult behavior, a lot of, I mean, deception, right? Deception in the sense of not being fully upfront and honest with who you are. And out of response to not feeling safe, perhaps, and out of trauma, out of grief and loss. So this is very important that we look at this, because I think Joseph seems to me to be an embodiment, perhaps, I'm going to venture out here, of who we are as Medinat Yisrael, as and not only as a people, as Am Yisrael, but as a nation state that under all conditions in the world of nation states, it is powerful, it is a player, has a great economy, has a very successful and large army and an arsenal of nuclear weapons. And all the things that go into what today would be described in under most conditions as a modern nation state that is successful and thriving, right? And it was founded and made up of an of Am Yisrael, of people who come from great grief and loss and trauma of a genocide. Trauma of ethnic cleansing from surrounding Arab countries and an intergenerational and collective trauma, and probably what we call I think it's called epigenic. It's almost a trauma in the DNA passed on from 2000, 2500 years of whether it's the Babylonians, Assyrians, the Greeks, the Romans, all the different communities throughout Europe and the Arab countries, who, whether it's pogroms or the horrible inequality or treatment, having the Jews be second-class citizens, till finally, obviously, the Shoah, the Holocaust in World War II. And the ethnic cleansing and just horrible behavior towards Jews in the Arab countries. And then finally, attempting to live and establish a state of Israel, trying to find a way with the neighbors who are there. This has been an ongoing struggle, and to where the conditions that we are today, essentially, where as a nation state, we are powerful, but we are often made up of people who are governing and living in this country are made up of people who maybe, and I include myself in this 100%, have to constantly be aware of and practice around that we now have power. And obviously with power is responsibility. And that we still can respond out of, and this is a form of reactivity, out of the grief and loss and the trauma that we live with us and carry with us, and that is still present. And the whole history of 75 years of constant battle and fighting with neighbors and those who live among us or next to us or with us, this also has just compounded reactivity. So why am I bringing this up? Yosef is an embodiment, in my opinion, of Medinat Yisrael. Okay, what is he? He was a boy, was 17, 18 years old, 17 probably, treated horribly by his own family. This part's not necessarily tied to Medinat Yisrael. I'm just giving you some bigger picture of who he is. He is thrown into this boar by his brothers, nine of them, it seems, Reuven. I don't include him in it. He is sold into slavery. He has to be, he's then imprisoned in Egypt for 12 more years, from age 18 to 30, right? And then he, he has this, this is, in my, and in my opinion, this is one of those where you see God, right, behind what's going on and also having a hand in things through something miraculous and God giving him the ability to interpret dreams. What happens? He is freed in a moment of great grace and unbelievable connection here. He is brought before the most powerful person in Egypt and immediately begins to take on the behavior that is needed to present. It's as if Yosef is aware of his moment, that this is it. He shaves himself, he cleanses himself. It's part of the whole assimilation process in order to be accepted among the most powerful Egyptian. And that will to try to fit in, to thrive, often is a response to grief and loss and trauma. And it's out of a rejection, right, of his own family and what has happened to him. So 22 years passed since his brothers, the 10 brothers, have seen Yosef. He is now 39 when they show up because of the famine, because there was a 7 year of plenty. So you add that on to age 30 after he gets out of prison. And then there's 2 more years in the famine when they finally come down. So he has moved from the most subjugated, difficult place to be in. He is a slave. He has lost all land, all connection, relationship with family, connected to his father, everything, birthplace, land, everything that Avraham was told, lech lecha, to leave your family home, the birthplace and the land and the people and everything you associate, leave it. Right? Yosef did not have consent. Yosef did not choose that, right? So Yosef, this young boy, 17, 18-year-old, is sent off, right? That is against his will. It's not what he chose for himself. And this is similar to what happens finally when Rome destroys our second temple, kidnaps the people, if it doesn't murder them, and takes them out, the ones who were there, takes them out and settles them in Rome, and then eventually other places throughout Europe. And then, of course, the Jews who were already in Arab lands or had settled there. Okay, so there's this scattering throughout the diaspora, just like Yosef now is scattered into Mitzrayim. He has no power there. He is enslaved. He's not believed when somebody accuses him of something. It's similar to how the Jews were treated. He is sent into prison for years. And so you think in those conditions, this would have broken any person. There is so much grief and loss and trauma. And Yosef, for the first time, has a huge shift. He chooses life. He chooses life in that bore, in that pit in prison. He recognizes the faces of the cupbearer, right? And the baker. He sees that they're crestfallen. It's the first time that he actually is looking at someone and recognizes them, and has developed enough emotional intelligence after years being in prison and maturing and growing up from that reptilian teenage brain to see them and see that they are in need of someone to listen to them. And he reaches out and he sees if he can be of assistance. Okay. That was the change of everything for Yosef. And I bring this up because this is very important for us as Jews today, or anyone who supports us and lives in Israel, or even in the diaspora, who is having much reactivity to the genocide of October 7th and the war afterwards, that we continue to see the faces of each other, especially, and others of our allies, and even those who we consider an enemy, to lehakir, to recognize, to pay attention to and see the face, to know what's going on. And then we can pivot. We can decide with discernment. Do we open the gates of our walled city, both metaphorically in our hearts and our souls, but also in Medinat Yisrael, in the nation of Israel and the country of Israel? There's a great story coming out from the Buddha that talks about that there's gated city, and the job of the gatekeeper is to decide when those approach who want to enter the city, if they are coming with wholesome, appropriate, wise, kind, compassionate, beautiful intentions, that they're coming to actually benefit the people inside the gate. And then using my language and the language of Musar, mindfulness, they're coming to enter the gate to bring God's good to the people inside. And so it's up to the gatekeeper to decide if you're going to let them in or not. It requires wise discernment. It requires seeing clearly. Yosef decided in that bor, he was seeing clearly. He decided to take a chance and reach out, develop a relationship, talk to them and listen to them. He created an ally in that moment. And that's so important for us. We are the gatekeepers of Israel and of our own souls right now and our own hearts. And each of us are in different places in response to this genocide and trauma. Some of us, it's a lower level of grief and loss. And we are healing and recovering slowly or coping. Then there's us who are just can barely even get by, right? Probably in therapy, probably seeking all sorts of help. But for the people over here, of any of us, that gate needs to be closed. That's self-preservation, right? That gatekeeper would say, not welcoming anyone in right now, unless it's 100% sure that we know that you have wonderful, excellent intentions for the person, right? And so this is what we're doing in Israel right now. We have decided that the Palestinians who live in Gaza and even in the West Bank do not have this appropriate, wise, compassionate, kind intention to enter our walled cities, to share with us in the bounty of our economy, and be a neighbor that could eventually form a neighboring nation state. And so it's very important that we be aware and see clearly who's coming to the gate, what are their intentions. All of us are really trying to survive from the lack of us being a strong enough gatekeeper on October 6th and October 7th that morning, and what preceded it. We were not seeing clearly. Some of us did not listen to what we needed to be awake, right? So Yosef, 22 years later, this is now a man who thinks that he, I think I, we could imagine that Yosef thinks that he has dealt with the trauma of his past. So much so, the evidence of that is when he names his children, particularly his firstborn, Menashe, right? He names his firstborn. And the meaning of it, essentially, coming out of this, is that he, in the attention of the name, the primary meaning, is he who causes to forget, right? And this is most likely a name given to a child after some misfortune, right? And Yosef really here adapts the name to his own situation. It's where he really feels like this child is now here, is represented that it's making him forget the suffering of his parental home. He's being able to not only cope, but move to healing and recovery, forming his own nuclear family. And he feels that he is being intelligent, having wise discernment about his own gate of who he's letting in, who he's letting into Egypt also to feed, right? So he's achieved now the social, emotional, physical, psychological security, right? That he absolutely did not have when his brothers ripped off his clothing, his katonet pasim, his lovely robe jacket given by his Abba, his father, and thrown into this pit, right? So he's able to, he thinks that he's able to have that security from quite a traumatic event that was unfolding and went on for years. So they show up. The brothers show up. And I want you to pay attention to the language here. Let's see if I have it right here. We are in chapter 42, and it's verse 7, Zion, okay? And it says, here, I'll read the English first. When Yosef saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he acted like a stranger toward them and spoke harshly to them, okay? So what is the language here? It's very important to know, to know this. So, Vayar Yosef et Echav, Vayakirem, okay? Vayit Naker Alechem. Okay, this is very important. To act like a stranger, right? It comes from Nochri, stranger. So it may be rendered actually a better translation than this which comes from one of the Torah translations here. I think this is JPS. Yes, the JPS Torah commentary on Genesis. I think a better term, if I was going to translate this, is that he hid his identity from him, right? And so that involves a form of what we have witnessed throughout this family, all the way from Avraham to Yitzhak to Yaakov, and now to Yosef, this deception. And not being truthful, right? Not being truthful. So I think that what's very important to start to recognize here is that immediately when he sees them, you can tell from his behavior that he's having reactivity because he hides himself. He closets himself. He chooses to have a false face. And the Kotzer Rebbe comes with a famous saying, and he says that those who put on a false face before the one who has no face, meaning Hashem here, God, this is a form of idolatry. This is a form of idolatry. Now, Yosef is putting on a false face before his brothers because he does not feel safe around them and he's reacting. All of a sudden, the 17-year-old boy is present. These are the people that hurt me and harmed me, who wanted me to die in that pit and only sold me because they, out of greed, they wanted to make some money. They actually wanted my blood. And he decides to hide himself. The effect of hiding oneself also affects the soul of the person. And we have to be aware of that in our own reactivity in response to this genocide and war. Of course, we're going to hide ourselves. We have to. It's a survival mechanism. Some of us will do fighting, some of us will do fawning, some of us will freeze, some of us will do flight. These are all normal and healthy responses in response to such a large trauma. Over time, we practice to eventually come out of the reactivity. So, what is shocking, if anything, that we're going to witness in rabbinic sources in the Parshanim, right, is how much judgment they have towards Yosef. I have to tell you, all my years of my life, when I studied this story from the time I was young till now, I never really had issue with Yosef's behavior towards his brothers when they come down. I almost saw it as like, of course he behaved that way, right? There was a compassionate response on my part, I believe, to understand that when someone's treated that way, they're going to have be the gatekeeper. They have to test out, do you actually have good intentions this time? Or are you the same people? And unfortunately, most of us who come from either a family like that, extended family like the Palestinians, neighbors, neighboring countries who are hostile, have had a history of hostility, trying to cause harm and suffering towards us, we're going to believe that that is the intention and going to continue. Some of us, as a maybe even a way as responding to trauma, we'll try to believe that people change and have good intentions, right? And try to form allies with some people, right? This happens. This happens even in Israel when there are shared groups between Israelis and Palestinians who try to forge a path of peace. So Yosef, in his own, to just give him compassion and have that response to him, this is what he needed to do. This is his reactivity in order to test after this 22 years. Are you the same brothers? Are you the same people who wanted to kill me, threw me in the pit, sold me into slavery, right? Okay. So even though Yosef later on gives as a reason that the brothers really aren't responsible in some ways because God sent him down there to save Egypt from the famine, to save everyone in the region. This behavior right here shows that even Yosef didn't 100% believe that. It's what he had to tell himself in healing and recovering and coping with what the brothers did. So we're going to hold on to that, all right? Because it gets used a lot, and I think in an inappropriate way by Parshanim and the rabbis. So let's look at some of this reactivity. Abravanel, has lost his mind. And I really love him as a commentator. He goes nuts over his behavior. He said, why did Yosef denounce his brothers? He said, surely it was criminal of him to take vengeance and bear a grudge like a viper, right? And he just can't, he said, what justification had he for taking vengeance after 20 years? So Ravenel feels like simply because there's been the passage of time, 20 years, that Yosef should be over that trauma, over what happened to him, and not have it arise, any of that reactivity, and want to have vengeance, right? How could he ignore their plight in a strange land and their family suffering famine and waiting for them, particularly his aged father? You know, why wasn't he worried and cared? How could he have not had pity on him? And how could he bear to inflict any further pain by imprisoning Shimon, right, his brother? I read this and I'm like, okay, we should just know that often in rabbinic commentary, there's a lot of judgment towards our ancestors. And, you know, some of you may feel that that's valid. I just feel like it's really usually unhealthy and unproductive. It's not a wise response when often our ancestors and we, in response to the text, need a compassionate response. And so okay, in the practice of the Dharma, there's this whole concept of seeing things as they are, not how we want them to be, in order to see clearly. And this commentary by Abravanel, and we'll see in some others, is seeing things that we, the way we want them to be, the way we think they should be, maybe by our moral compass and our values, which is fine, but it's not looking at things at how the way they are, right? And so the way it is that Yosef, although he looked like he had gone through some form of healing and recovery in Egypt, to the point where he names his son Menashe, that I've forgotten this very ugly, awful past, that all is fine and good when he doesn't have to actually live with his family or see them. They show up on the scene, and all of a sudden, and this could happen to any of us. This could happen to people after years of therapy, of dealing with an unhealthy family, and we think that we're healed, that we've dealt with it, that we don't have reactivity towards it anymore. It's not kind of controlling our lives or defining who we are. And then all of a sudden, we see the person who hurt us or harmed us, or our bucket's full and some other horrible thing happens in our lives, maybe a car accident or something else, and it brings up the whole thing again. And so this is what we're witnessing. Yosef is, you know, clearly having to now face a whole new level of coping, and then we'll see the path of healing and reconciliation, perhaps. Okay, so what happens in the story? I want to say the root of the trauma that goes on through this whole dialogue with his brothers in this Torah portion, Miketz, and even what happened before, is that his brothers from the very beginning, when he was 17, did not respond wisely to Yosef's suffering, right? He's crying from the pit, which we learn in this Torah portion in Miketz. They choose to not listen to it or hear it. They act with delusion. They act with greed. They act with ill will. Okay. The hindrances are there. And they also did not respond wisely with their own self-compassion towards their own suffering. They were not in touch with that at all. And what do I mean by that? For years, they dealt with a father, Yaakov, that favored one mother, Rachel, who then he favored one son, Yosef, and he loved him more than all the other brothers. That caused harm and suffering to the brothers. And they took it out on Yosef. So there was no wise practice in response to their own suffering. There was no self-compassion there. There wasn't even a recognition of it properly, right? There was just an acting out of it. Oh, I see Yosef, ill will. I hate you. I'm going to take out my anger out on you because of my dad, my Abba, what he did, right? So Yaakov also was under delusion. He was ignoring the suffering of his sons. He didn't even know how much they hated him, hated Yosef or him. And even the Torah itself does not record or recognize Yosef's suffering until Miketz. You don't hear that he's crying from the boar during the parsha where he does that, right? So no one is bearing witness to this, any of this ongoing lack of recognition and pain, all right? So this is the danger of trauma, and this is something we have to just be aware of too, to recognize our own pain and suffering, because we're not going to get it necessarily from others properly the way that we need and want, and certainly from the people, the Palestinians who caused us harm and suffering on October 7th and onward. We're not going to get that. May we seek the proper support from our allies, but the biggest support is going to be us recognizing the true harm and suffering, practicing self-compassion, because that's the only place that we're going to get it and need to heal. And may they do their own work also. We can't rely on it. All right. So essentially what happens here is that it's only after Yosef hears, he's privileged to hear his brothers admit verbally to one another that they believe that they are, Shimon is being held as a slave, prisoner, and that they were caught essentially by God, that the wheel of cause and effect and of consequence has come rolling in, right? As the Nachama Leibowitz says, that train will arrive. And that train has arrived. Essentially, he overhears his brother's awareness of their sin, that God has come in to collect. God is aware of what we did to Yosef. He hears this. That's such a privilege. That's such a privilege that he gets access to this admission of hearing this. We're not, the only time you hear admission of sin of, for instance, what happens on October 7th of the genocide is when people are arrested, both Palestinians and active terrorists for Hamas, they're interrogated and you get some admission there. But otherwise we don't get it. You don't have a people coming and saying, wow, like this is God's punishment. This is God rolling in for what we did. We recognize and take responsibility for it. So Yosef gets this, right? He gets to hear that they know they're being punished because of their behavior towards him. And as I said, when most of us will never receive such a admission of sin by whoever hurts us, whoever causes us harm and suffering. And so we have to do this work on our own. It's a singular reconciliation then, right? It has to be done on our own for our own souls so that we heal, right? And it's very important, okay? So when the brothers finally, in this story, I was going to share with you one more hyper-reactivity towards, right here, for instance, of let's see here, proselyter commentators. What ends up happening with the reactivity of the parshanim of the rabbis of the sages is Ramban comes in and feels that Yosef had to perform this deception and not being honest, truthful, and that he carried out everything in, this is his own language, in an appropriate manner in order to fulfill the dreams, right? Okay, every person's going to have their own reactivity to Yosef's behavior. And so this one's trying to justify his behavior. Then we have Rabbi Yitzhak Rama in his Akedat Yitzhak, who he actually says, I'm absolutely astonished at Rambam's explanation of what Yosef did in order to have his dreams come true. He said he should not have sinned against his father. they see it as him sinning against his father to cause him harm and suffering that he's going to have to prolong and live in this famine and then live with the pain that he doesn't have Shimon or even Benjamin later to go home to. He thinks it's up to that he should have left it to Hashem to cause these dreams to come true, right? So anytime there is reactivity and concealment and deception, we have to look at it as much as we can with compassion and try to understand what's going on. And so what happens in the Torah portion is the brothers finally have that recognition towards Shimon. They finally have compassion. They can, through having compassion for Shimon, they start to have it for themselves. Their recognition of Shimon and their own. The brothers here really try to continue to pivot in resource to try to survive this famine and the wrath of Yosef, okay? Who all they know him to be is this prime minister of Egypt, this vicar, right? And so towards the end, when it gets really feeling out of control and Yosef is, I think, at the height of reactivity of deciding, is he really going to keep Benjamin? Who, if he does, could potentially cause his father to die, the ultimate suffering. He prolongs them being stuck and staying there. If he decides to imprison all of them or enslave all of them because they don't want to leave without Benjamin, then there's no food that goes back up to the young ones, to the women, and to his father, Yaakov. He's at this pinnacle of, it's actually kind of a lose-lose, right? In the sense that it's gambling in the sense of grasping for power in order to get the response that you want. That's what we witnessed Yosef doing. And that's why I tie Yosef to, he's this larger metaphor for Medinat Yisrael, because we, as much as we feel so victimized and full of our suffering, it's important to see that and honor it and have the self-compassion. And there's an and here, not or. And we have to recognize that we have great power with our state and our military and the potential, and that we have to constantly be checking that as gatekeeper, but also that we don't overreact, that we don't act even from reactivity if we're able to, because we can cause harm and suffering on a level that's larger than our own victimization, right? That's larger than our own harm and suffering from the genocide and afterwards, right? We're bringing 2,000, 2,500 years with us. It's always there. It's always present. And we have to be mindful of that compassionately. Yosef was bringing all those years with his brothers and what happened at 17 right to the forefront. And at his ultimate moment of the highest amount of power, he could hold on to Benjamin, cause his father unbelievable pain and potential death, hold on to all the brothers as slaves. No food goes back up. They die in the famine, causing unbelievable harm and suffering to more souls than even he intended, right? So he's at this moment, he's at this crossroad, and Yehuda, the fourth son of Leah, ends up standing up, and he is willing to sacrifice himself, right? He says, no, I will stay instead of Benjamin, right? You can't let him stay here. You have to, he's being a new gatekeeper. He says, this has to be done appropriately because there's other souls involved. You have to let Benjamin go, right? And I think he's finally able to see Lehakir. He's able to see the amount of pain and power struggle here and that there's something else behind it, right? He's finally able to see his own sins and that he's responsible for them, right? He might even in this moment, no one talks about this, but he might be tapping into the implication that this sin is also about the death of his two sons, of Er and Onan, that he's somehow responsible for that, right? Of not seeing clearly, of not being gatekeeper. And then the pain and suffering that he had caused Tamar, to wait all those years to the point where her only resource as a woman with no power is to go out and prostitute herself, to sleep with her own father-in-law, right? To possibly get Shelah, the son that she was supposed to marry, ends up being pregnant with twins. All that is before you, Yehuda, in that moment. He is seeing clearly. He's seeing what he did to Yosef. He's seeing what he did with his sons. And finally, the third son, where he did not offer the son to Tamar to marry. He's seeing what happened with Tamar and his own responsibility in it. It's in that moment that he's like, this is it. This is it. I am going to respond with the most wholesome way and alignment with my values, with my moral compass. And this is it. I'm putting myself on the line for Binyamin. And it's the beautiful words of his father, Yaakov, before he even sends him down with Yaakov, with Binyamin. He says, may God make the man, meaning Yosef, the visor, show mercy towards you. They had done everything they could in their power. The rest is up to God. And that is where we are. Yosef really captures this for us, right? We are at those crossroads where we must be the healthiest gatekeeper that we possibly can be, all while recognizing the full history of our trauma, of our recovery, the grief and loss, and the resilience that we try to practice daily with God's help, that we respond as wisely as we can, as compassionately as we can, being very clear and sure that we are the only ones responsible for being our own gatekeeper of our own souls, our own health, and of our borders and of our people. And so that we, like Yosef, had to be aware of our power, of our state, and of our military, to obviously assess that like a gatekeeper each day. Can I resource? Can I pivot? We never want to get to the point where we are locked into only one behavior. We always want to be able to pivot if we need to, while at the same time carrying this burden, right, of caring for ourselves and slowly coping, potentially healing and recovering. So God obviously knew the brother's sin in the Torah. And it almost seems as if Hashem, God, was waiting patiently for them to face their own, to face the sin on their own, right? To take responsibility for willing to sacrifice themselves in that moment, particularly Yehuda, but to stay and remain as slaves. I think that's very important. It shows, and then at that moment, which we'll see coming up very soon, the next parsha that we will cover is Vayigash, where we finally will see Yosef come out after Yehuda's speech to him, right? Where he finally is able to witness that they really have changed, right? There is a moment of teshuvah there, where the same opportunity, it's like Rambam's perfect moment of teshuvah that never, none of us ever really get to get, where the same conditions in some way have arisen, right? Binyamin is the favored son of Yaakov. Here's an opportunity to enslave him and leave him there, right? If they were still the same immature brothers of ill will and delusion and greed that they were 22 years earlier, they could have still acted out towards their father by hurting the youngest son. And that moment was there for them to do. And they chose otherwise. They chose the right, just, compassionate path, right? They said, no more. We're not going to do this to our father. We are aware of what we've done. Okay. And then that's a gift. That's a gift to Yosef to be able to go move through healing and recovery, and also for them long term. So in the next parsha, which I encourage you to read if you haven't, it comes up in chapter 45, Vayigash, which we will cover together after this one. And you will get to see finally the gatekeeper be able to open the gates to his heart and to the land in a really wise, compassionate way. Yosef will embrace them. And this goes until chapter 47, verse 27. So let's move into our practice of mindfulness meditation together. May we continue to learn, have the privilege to learn from our ancestors and God, of how we can really use these beloved stories to know how to be the gatekeepers today. How do we pivot and respond? How do we face our grief and loss and potential trauma so that we can be on this path slowly together? So with that, I invite you to take a posture of steadiness, of groundedness. I invite you to close your eyes if you feel safe and comfortable, at ease. Otherwise, just lower your gaze. We're immediately going to bring our loving attention to the felt sense of the body. What does your body feel like right now with the feet firmly on the ground? If you're seated in a chair like me, feeling up into the legs, into the sit bones, being as heavy as possible on the seat, really grounding you so that you are in the here and now. Moving up into this beautifully erect spine, full of dignity as you are created in the image and the likeness of the divine, but also at ease. Moving up into your head, into your heart, really feeling the full body. Bringing your mind into the body, unifying, integrating body, mind, soul, present moment. Been over 2.5 months. Since the genocide of October 7th. We've been riding these waves, which is the only thing we can do. And now is the hizdamnut, the opportunity to really tap into the mida and state of equanimity, of menuchat ha-nefesh. Now, equanimity in the Musar tradition does not mean that we're calm and asleep. Rather, it's more the image of you're on that subway train that is going super fast and then stops suddenly, then begins again, and you're holding on to those brackets that happen to be hanging on the bar above. Or you're on that surfboard or maybe even a boat and you're riding calmly at first. And then large waves start to come and you somehow manage riding those, maybe even a tsunami like October 7th. And you're fully aware that you are riding enormous waves You're aware of all the feeling underneath the surfboard. It affects the whole body, the felt sense. And you're still staying on the board. You're aware of what is around you. This is equanimity. It's a great sensitivity to the changing landscapes that affect us all the time, the conditionality of life. One day is October 6th. You're preparing to celebrate Simchat Torah and Shemini Atzeret here in Israel. Sensitive to the changing sensations in the body. And then that landscape changes. It's 6:30 in the morning on October 7th. Nothing standing still, nothing fixed. Being able to zoom out and know you are part of that whole large ocean, even if the waves at your shore are very large, feel out of control. There is still the larger ocean, a process of change and movement, an unfolding landscape sensitive to the life of your heart and mind just now. Knowing that in this process of change, of rising and passing thoughts, emotions, sensations in the body, images, nothing standing still, nothing permanent. Just like Yosef, who thought he was riding the waves of the 7 years of plenty quite well, they were calm. And even he had managed so well to handle entering the famine. And all of a sudden, 10 brothers appear before him. Those waves weren't calm anymore. The waters were not still. We too, now expanding the field of our awareness to be mindful of sounds coming, going, changing. Knowing that we stand in the midst of this. Touching the world, being touched by the world. Inviting into our field of awareness right now. Oh, a deep recollection of the people most dear to us that we care for. Sensing the response in the body and the heart and mind, the tenderness, the caring, the affection. And now, like Yosef, allowing the brothers to enter the room. We allow into our field of awareness the people that we struggle with. Whether it's this conflict, whether it's hurt, recognizing them in the circle of awareness. The surrounding us, caring for us, standing at the gate of our gated city, are those who love and care for us that we had recalled. They too sensitive to the responses that are arising inwardly. Unease, fear, or ill will. Knowing that we stand in the midst of this, we stand in the midst of our loved ones, of recognizing our allies, of trying to cope, heal, recover, and still having enemies, those we struggle with, those we don't trust. in the midst of all of this. Sensing what it is to be here with the lovely and the unlovely, with the pleasant and the unpleasant. Asking ourselves, can we hold this? Can we move towards and not away? Equally present for it all on our surfboard, aware of the safety boat, the boat that's come to throw us what we need to survive the waves thrown at us. Knowing that both the people that we love and those that we struggle with are essentially the children of conditions in their own lives. Doing their best, perhaps, doing what they can. Recognizing that our loved ones are trying to find their own care, compassion. Knowing that they hold their own hands, and even those that we don't trust hold their own keys to their own freedom, to their own flourishing. And they also hold in their own hands the keys to their own distress and their own struggle. And we too, and how we respond to this. Stand before us two paths. That of flourishing and freedom, and that of distress and struggle. Knowing that we can care, that we can love, that we can support, and we are not in control of so much. And we recall in this moment the words of our beloved ancestor Yaakov as he says to the sons as they head down one last time with Binyamin down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. May God cause the man in control to have mercy on you. Recognizing that so much is out of our control. Sensing what it is to allow ourselves to be surprised by those we love who are being gatekeepers. What would it mean to tap into the potential of being surprised by those we may struggle with, to calm our knowing, to know that all is changing, fluid. Dynamic human beings that can surprise us, perhaps. Can we find acceptance in not knowing? Maybe ease. Can we find stillness in not knowing? And of course, for ourselves and those that we love and care for, we can always deep intention say to ourselves and them, I care for you deeply. But sometimes we can't protect ourselves from distress, the dukkha of life, that things arise. And even among facing those most difficult in our lives, at our borders, on the other side, standing, supporting, and trusting our beloved soldiers in the midst of the hurt, in the midst of the fear, in the midst of the ill will, planting our feet firmly on the ground, knowing that we can meet this with balance over time. Poise. Bringing a compassionate equanimity to the difficulties within and to the difficult people in our lives. Finding steadiness, balance amidst the waves of this difficult time. Bringing forward that intention. May I find steadiness and balance amidst the mist, amidst the waves of the difficult. I'm taking refuge in this community, knowing that if any one of us at any time fall off that surfing board, that we will be here for one another. We will throw that inflatable device or the life vest. We will be there with the boat. We will surround you with our own surfboards, letting you know that not always can we ride the waves of life with balanced equanimity. Expanding our awareness to know and acknowledge, to see clearly the life that we live in right here and right now. Not how we want things to be, but how they are right now. Can we see clearly with all the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows? In the midst of this life, finding that ground of steadiness and stillness, taking refuge in community and the teachings and the path and in God. Knowing that God is with us in these joys and sorrows, may we remain grounded by life's rise and fall. Sensing inwardly in the body that quality of stillness, the quality of groundedness. The deep inhalation and exhalation. Again, taking in the gift of oxygen from Hashem, from God, a deep inhalation and exhalation. This time, raising your shoulders to your ears, inhalation, and letting them rest and fall, exhalation. Like our breath, all things change, all things pass. Letting the breath fall to its own natural rhythm. Not moving towards the breath or away from it, not moving towards the reactivity or away from it, including it all. The 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 joys. May we find rest and ease in not knowing. May we find refuge in this practice and in the stillness together. May we find easeful of heart. One small practice, one small task to continue exploring this ground, this groundedness, this balance, one small act you can do each day to practice this radical self-care, to develop into the wise gatekeeper of your own heart and soul and of your people and of your lands of Medinat Yisrael, of the nation state of Israel, requires such support and wise discernment and practice. We enter into silent meditation now, allowing yourself to bathe in the groundedness and the stillness. I will ring the bell when it's time to come out of our sitting meditation. Recognizing this gift of radical self-compassion. This practice together, allowing you to tap into such divine, deep, holy resources for yourself to be able to bring God's good to others over time. Bowing to God, bowing to the courage of your practice, bowing to you showing up, committing to this path together, joining the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness, on this amazing path of Musar Mindfulness to really support one another. Today is our 10th sitting on, it's now December 25th, about 2 in the morning here in Israel. And I thank you for showing up. To all of you who are celebrating Christmas, we here at the Institute wish you a happy, merry, joyful, really present Christmas, being really present for the gift of however you observe it, whether you're secular, Christian, mixed family, tapping into the well of the resources of a festival of lights in some ways, and the deep, deep love and compassion towards one another. We are great allies. We must continue to support one another, as we know, in this larger world theater of facing a clash of civilizations that we have to be wise together and be gatekeepers. So again, I'm Rabbi Chassi Uriel Steinbauer, founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, HaMachon LeKedusha. This sitting today is in honor of Jill Spanier, who is a beloved student of mine and a member of the Institute, practitioner of Musar Mindfulness, who has been hospitalized for a respiratory infection, perhaps issues of the heart. So we all hold her deeply in our prayers and heart, and also in prayers of full health and healing, of refuah shlema, a speedy recovery, God willing, to Steve Edelstein and Ron Gaskill. I hope I'm saying the names correctly. Please correct me if I'm not. Yeah, holding it all, being present for it all. So we will join again soon, Bezrat Hashem, for the next Torah portion. And I look forward to it. Look forward to practicing together for Vayigash. God bless. Take care.